I'm Jim and I'm an alcoholic.
I want to thank VJ and the committee for asking me to share tonight. I'm really grateful to be here and to be somewhat sane. And it's I marvel every day at the miracle that has taken place in my life, and it's thanks to you people in rooms like this and this program that has given me a chance to live and to be able to enjoy life a little bit. It's really an honor to be able to share the podium with Mr. Kendall. I admire you too. You told my story. Kendall mentioned that he had worked, you know, he goes to work before dark and comes home after dark. I did that for many years. I'll probably tell you something about that before I'm done. The executives brought him the message. Utah State Prison brought me mine. Executives. Today I make a lot of jokes about being a part of that life, and some days it doesn't seem like it's real. Some days it seemed like it happened to someone that I knew, and I realize today that it did. The thing in me finally died, and that all that stuff that happened to me, it happened to another person. And it was through the efforts of you people and that I've had that opportunity to change. All of my life I have wanted to be somebody else and somewhere else. And it is not like that tonight. I'm very comfortable being right here in this room with fellow sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I first came here, I didn't want to be sober. I didn't want to know you people. You were all too old. I was 19, you were all about 35, I couldn't relate. None of those things had happened to me. But I kept coming back and I stayed long enough to hear some of the things you were telling me. You told me some things that would happen to me if I didn't stop drinking. I didn't believe you. And being the brain that I thought I was, I had to go out there and experience all of those things. I have a very loving mother that is in the audience tonight, and I'm so very proud to have her here. And I have other members of my family here, my blood family, many friends. I always wanted to be wanted, and you've all heard me say this before, but I ended up being wanted by the FBI in 23 states. That's not what I had in mind. That's not what I had in mind when I took my first drink. I took my first drink to make the pain go away, to be able to be comfortable around other people. And I took the first drink really quite by accident. It was nothing that I had planned. If I thought it had been a big deal, I'd have kept track of the date and said, on such and such a day, I took my first drink. It wasn't like that. I had watched the man that raised me drink out of a bottle that was in the barn, and it was the nastiest shit I'd have ever seen, the Southern Comfort. And I took a drink, and it did exactly what I wanted it to do. It felt good. I had a lot of fun with booze. I had a lot of good times. And somewhere along the way, that all changed. Many years ago, I was in a VA recovery program in the early 60s, and their attitude then was, if we could find the underlying reason why you drink, you wouldn't have to drink anymore. And I went to that program and had the people working with me to find out the reason why I drank. I don't think they understood, and they don't understand today, that I drank in the early days because I wanted to. And then I had to drink because I had to. I had to live to drink, and I had to drink to live. And I don't know when I crossed that line. I often look back that I was alcoholic from the first drink. I come from a long, long line of alcoholics. My father's side, my mother's side. I don't know. I've heard that we have extra genes, or we have no genes, or we have sense or no sense, you know. It doesn't really matter to me. But while I was in that program, I shared with them that I was born out of wedlock, and when you're born in the early 40s, and early 40s, how about 1940? Is that early enough? And I was born in that situation. My dad was overseas. My mother was alone. And there was a terrible stigma put on people in those days. My grandmother was also a nut, and as I learned later on as I got older and saw some of those things going on, and she put her in a place called the poorhouse. And I need to touch just a bit. I have a niece that just had a baby that she opted to give up. She was not willing to change her lifestyle. Her attitude was, I can't take care of myself. What am I going to do with a baby also? So she put the baby up for adoption. I spent quite a lot of time with her, basically trying to convince her that maybe she shouldn't do that. Because today I am very grateful that my mother went through the pain that she had to go through for many years, but she didn't give me up. I'm very proud of her. There's a lot of love that I would have never have experienced had that happened. My mother found out I was going to talk tonight, and she said, let it all hang out. And I wish I could have my present here that I got at my birthday party. I would show you how I let it all hang out. I don't have it with me, but maybe I can describe it. It's about that long and about that big around. When I was in school, there were no drugs, and you know, the only thing that was the in thing in those days was booze. And I was raised with a bunch of kids that their fathers made homebrew, and they made dandelion wine and all of those things. And we found out very early how to find all of that stuff and how to steal it without getting caught. And I thought everyone did that, because all of the people that I hung around with did that. I never knew a social drinker. I didn't want to be around a social drinker. I happened to go to a party in Oklahoma City one Christmas, and I went with a friend who was a sober member of this program, whose brother was with him. And the host met us at the door and asked his brother, would you care for a drink? And he said, no, I had one today. I never knew anyone that had one. I never understood that if a party started Friday, I didn't have to stay until Monday. I never understood that if you had a bottle of whiskey, you could have one drink and then put it back. A few months ago, I was sitting in Denny's, and it was early in the morning, and there was an elderly man sitting there with who I took to be his daughter and her hungover boyfriend. And they were talking about drinking, and she said, I came home yesterday, and I was really tired, and I had a lot of work to do. I had the lawn to mow, and I had the house to clean, and I had dinner to cook, and on and on and on. And she said, I had a bottle of brandy in the cupboard, so I took a couple of drinks, and God, I came to life, and I got all of that work done, and I felt so good. And the old man said, you know, when his wife was sick, he bought a bottle of brandy. He said, I think maybe I'll go home today and have a drink of that too. It's been up there 14 years. I don't understand those things. I understand me going into a bar down on Skid Row in this city, on a Sunday morning, and there's one man in there that has a bottle. I can't find the bootlegger. I am really sick. These are the kinds of things that I understand. I asked the man if I can buy a drink, and he said no. I said, could I have one? And he said no. So I proceeded to just smash the bottle all over the floor. I made up my mind, I'm not drinking this son of a bitch, ain't gonna drink either. I learned really early how to survive. And I think as I look around this program and I read in the book and I listen to people talk about character defects and some of those things, I understand today that I am not punished for having those defects, but I can be punished by them. But I think some of those defects of character that I had saved my life. It gave me a chance to survive long enough to get sober, to get here. I learned early how to put my back against the wall and do whatever was necessary for me to survive. Some of the things were not very pretty. I hurt a lot of people. I hurt everyone that I ever came in contact with. I used and abused as long as they would let me use and abuse them. And it wasn't until the time came that I had used up everyone in my life, all of my friends, all of my relatives, and I was sitting alone in a cell in Utah State Prison that I had a chance to get sober. I had a chance to be able to live. It's a long way from Underhill, Vermont, a little town of about 700 people, to this night, some 30 years later. I've always had a dream since I've been around AA that my two kids in Vermont would someday get sober and straight. Nancy and I had an opportunity to go to Montreal to the 50th International Convention. And being born and raised about 90 minutes from Montreal, I had a lot of time to spend with my family, my kids. My son has been in jail three different times for three DUIs. He is walking every step of the way that he can in my footsteps. And I had always had a dream that someday I could be talking at an AA meeting somewhere and my kids would be in that audience and they would be sober and they would be straight. Ironically enough, I talked in Burlington, Vermont the 3rd of July, just prior to going to Montreal. My son was at his first AA meeting. He was not at that one, but he was at another one. And just like his father, he had to show me what to do. Friday, he was drunk again. I understand those kinds of things. We had an opportunity to take him out to eat with my daughter. And it's like looking in a mirror, not accepting the fact that he might be alcoholic, not wanting to let anyone know that maybe he can't handle what is going on with him. And he ordered a drink with dinner. And I could sit there and watch the pain as he's nursing that drink. Took a long time to get the first one down. You know, you want to be social and you want to do the right thing. And then he ordered the second one, and that went a little quicker. And then the wringing of the hands and the nervousness and can't wait to get out of there so he can get into the bar. And we left him at the bar. I understand today that when I became teachable, the teacher appeared. And I can do and say everything that I know to this young man. If he is not ready, there's nothing that I can do or say to keep him here. And if he is ready, there's nothing that I can do or say to drive him away. I understand through you people in this program today that I only need to become willing, that I only need to show up. God will take care of the rest of it. I had always believed in God. I had two or three different gods that I believed in. I understand a little better today what my higher powers were. They weren't necessarily God in those days. One of them was booze and the other one was pussy. Kendall talked about cocktail waitresses. I've often thought that I'd like to go back on some of the roads that I have been down over the last few years. And the ones that I can remember, you know, just to say hi and renew old acquaintances. And see if it's that good the second time around, but I don't need to do that today. But these gods that I would pray to them whenever I was in trouble or whenever I was in jail, whenever things were not going my way. Nothing ever went my way. It just didn't work. I had every opportunity in life that there was. But I was so busy using and abusing people and playing my mother against my grandmother and all of those games that I learned to play very early in life that I missed all of that stuff. A judge in Burlington, Vermont had befriended me when I was about 14. I learned to drive very early, and when a person learns to drive and he wants to get a little mobile, he has to do something. You know, Christ, you can't ride a bicycle when you're macho and you're drinking, and God, it's tough to try to go steal a case of beer on a bicycle. So I learned very early how to hotwire cars and do all of those kinds of things. And back in those days, you know, it wasn't too tough to get somebody's car. Those old farmers went to bed at dark, and they didn't get up till early in the morning. And I had an opportunity to meet this judge. God, this is the first time I ever talked about this. I had an opportunity to meet this judge when I was about 13 or 14. And we became friends, and he offered me a lot of opportunities. I had expressed to him that I had always wanted to be a state trooper. And he was willing to put up his own money and send me to college, and so I could do those kinds of things. And he opted to do a lot of things if I would simply go to school and quit doing all of those things. And I had it all. That same summer, I ran away from home and joined the circus. I recommend that to any young man at 14 or 15 today. I think that's the greatest... Wow! I grew up in a hurry. My first job with the circus, I had gone to work in a restaurant. This is getting back to my learning how to survive very early. And I worked for an Armenian guy, and he had a big snogs on him, and the end of the week came and he wouldn't pay me. You know, he's got me 300 or 400 miles from home, and I'm just a kid, and he doesn't want to pay. And all of the plates were stacked up along the thing in the center of this tent where we served all this food, and I just started knocking stacks of plates off. And about the third stack I got to, he, wait a minute, I'll pay you. He did. Then I went to work on a girly show. I was selling tickets, and I bought some tickets. I believe that summer was I could write a book on just the things that happened in those few short months. When you're 14 years old, I was as tall then as I am now, and in the meantime, I'd gotten a couple of tattoos, you know, to be really in with the... What the hell do they call those people? So, no, people that work in fairs and circuses. God, I must be growing. I forget what they call them. Carnies! Thank you! And tattoos had festered and infected. I always wore a short-sleeved shirt so I could show off those things. And drinking in the bars in the state of New York and doing all of those things. And in the meantime, I had lost all my clothes. And here I am, a young kid on a big semi-truck pulling into Plattsburgh, New York. The greatest... God, I got chills just thinking about it. Here's my mother and my grandfather, my grandmother waiting at the gate for me. And I went home. By this time, I had learned a lot more. I had learned that there are other things in life than going to school and being honest and being good. And God, I learned so much so fast. Another little story that I need to share. When I wasn't with my mother, I was being raised by my grandmother. And she really wasn't too hard on me. I mean, I could do about anything I wanted to. And come to find out years later, she had been a dope fiend for years. And it wasn't until I was about 16 or 17 that I realized this. But every couple of weeks or so, we'd have to get up in the middle of the night and take her to the doctor to give her what she called a hypo. She had a back pain. And he would give her this hypo, and she would kind of flop around and lay around for a week or 10 days. And then, the process would go on. Well, being in this prone position most of the time, she couldn't do a lot of housework. She was a lousy housekeeper anyway. But she decided that she would hire a girl to come in and help her clean the house. And this girl happened to be a year older than I. And she knew the ways about the world, too. And God. What a gift. They slept downstairs, and there were five bedrooms upstairs, and Joyce and I had the run of the five bedrooms. And I don't know if I wore her out or she got sick of me, but after she'd been there a while, she sent her younger sister down. And of course, I had to pass on to her what I learned from her older sister. And that, that kind of stuff kept happening throughout my life. It just on and on and on and on. This summer, I had an opportunity to meet with the kid that I started drinking with when we were about 13 or 14 years old. We had learned that we could go to a barn dance, and while the people were dancing, we would go through the cars and pick up the booze and all of those things, and we would hide them in a junkyard in an old car that we had. That was ours. That was our car. And we would sit there at night and just drink. And I often wondered what happened to Doug. And when we were back in Burlington this past July, I called him. And I wanted to make sure that I had the right guy, so I mentioned one incident that had happened that only he and I knew about. And he said, "Hi, Jim. It's been 25 years since I've talked to this man." And we had an opportunity to get together and to share school days. And Nancy and I were very open as to where we were going, and I was very open with what had happened to me. And I was very resentful, and I was very angry that, I said to him, "What happened with your drinking? My drinking has caused me all of this pain and all of these problems." And he said, "Well, I went to college, and when I turned 21, I decided, this drinking isn't really any good. I'll just quit." And I thought to myself, "You little prick, you don't know the pain I've been through." We got together with, 12 or 13 other classmates, and we shared a couple of evenings, and it was really comfortable for me to be able to share where I had been and the things that I had gone through. And once again, I didn't understand the difference between social drinking and alcoholic drinking. I still have a hard time with that today. Enough of a drunkologue for me. I really like to talk about how my life has changed over the years. I need to tell you very briefly for those that don't know me. When I came to Utah 18 years ago, I left a wife and two kids in Vermont. I just drove away. I thought that was the only manly thing I could do. I knew I was drinking and I was going down the tube, and I wanted to go alone. I didn't want to take them with me. So I just drove away one day. I went to get the newspaper and some donuts and never went back. And I didn't go back for 13 years. Some of that was my doing. Some of it, the places that I was in, I couldn't get out very often. And there are a couple of men in this room tonight that used to come and see me on a weekly basis. We had an AA meeting out there at the Golden Key chapter. But when I came to Utah, my drinking had progressed to such a point that I could no longer work. And in order to support myself the way I wanted to, I had to do some other things. And I opted to steal. One of the hazards of stealing, you go to jail a lot. And I learned early on that you need to keep a lawyer and you need to keep a bondsman at the ready. You know, you never know when you're going to need one. And it seemed like I needed one on a daily basis somewhere. And after I was caught in a warehouse down here and they sicked the police dogs on me and all of those things, once again I was due to go to trial and I knew that what was going to happen. And I really had a lot of fear in those days. And you know, I cover fear with some kind of a macho attitude and just don't let anybody too near you. But I was really afraid. And the day came that I was due to go to trial, and I did the only thing that I knew what to do. I ran. And I ran for a couple of years. And that gets a little old when you're drinking alcoholically. You got 6 or 7 warrants out on you, and you're out on bail on 6 or 7 different charges, and you can't do a lot of things, and you don't have a driver's license, and you don't have any ID, and you know, I didn't know who the hell I was from one day to the next. I didn't know what person I was when I was in this bar, and a lot of times I couldn't go back there because I didn't know who I was and what name I'd given them, and people would come up and call me by a name that I had never used before, and that went on and on and on. I found some very classy places to hide. At 19, when I was married, I married a girl that, as I looked back then, she was above my station, but she came from a family of a lot of money, and I figured that this would help me with my deal. And we went into the restaurant business and the bar business. Nice place for an alcoholic to be. Practicing alcoholic. And I had learned to cook, and I worked in some very exclusive clubs all over the country. A nice place to hide, because people don't look for you in those kinds of places. And today I'm really grateful that I had 6 or 7 different personalities, because as I have stated before, it kept me alive long enough to get here. And one day I was walking down the street in Pasadena, California, and a man walked up to me and said, "Are you Jim Lombard?" And I said, "No." He said, "What is your name?" And I gave him some name, you know, one of the many that I had dreamed up. And he said, "Well, let's go down and talk about it at the office." That was the beginning of the end for me. This man was a member of the FBI, and from there I came back to Salt Lake, and from there I went to the penitentiary for burglary. And I knew the minute I walked through the doors of that prison and they clanged behind me and all of those sounds, I don't know if I had a spiritual awakening at that moment, but I knew that I was in a place where I didn't have to drink anymore. I didn't have to drink to live. I didn't have to live to drink. Maybe something would happen. And I know today that God in his infinite wisdom knew that he had to put me in a place where I could slow down long enough to listen. And these ladies and men would bring the message out there. I see one other man in this room tonight that was with me in that prison years ago. And I'm glad that he's here tonight, and I'm glad that he's sober. I see a couple that were bringing the message to me. And I'm really grateful to those people. I have spent a long time going out there on a regular basis on Friday nights. Not so much for them, but for me. I go out there and pay a little bit on my insurance policy. I know that one drink and I'm back. These people spoon-fed me, and I would listen. and I would be willing to do the things that they told me to do. And after being locked up almost 2 years, I only had three thoughts. What I was going to do the day I got out. And this was being straight and clean and sober. And I understand today that there's a lot of peer pressure in those kinds of situations. You know, like you're going to AA meetings and you're not drinking and you're not using drugs. And I had a lot of friends there when I got there that I had known on the street. And I'm going to all these AA meetings. The three thoughts I had the day I was due to get out was where I was going to get laid, where I was going to get drunk, and how I was going to live, excuse me, the way I wanted to without drinking, without working. Insanity. And needless to say, I was only out for 3 months and 3 weeks. I went absolutely apeshit. I was 28 years old when I found speed. And speed mixed with the booze was doing for me for a short period of time what the alcohol did at the very beginning. I could get almost there again. I also found that I could drink for 5 or 6 days and not go to bed and be a part of and carry on 4 or 5 conversations at the same time. And there may not be anybody there but me, but I could do that. I loved it. I hear Nancy talk about taking one dextrodrine a day for 27 years. I don't understand that. I understand taking from 500 to 1,200 meth tabs a day. I understand those things. I understand my addictive personality. The more, the better. There came a time when I became willing again. I was released one more time, and after 27 months, I decided to drink again. And when you're on parole, there are some things that you need to do. If I wanted to open up a checking account, I would have to ask. If I wanted to get married, I would have to ask. If I wanted to leave the state, I would have to ask. Needless to say, a person of my stature, I wouldn't ask. So I left the state, and I went to Las Vegas. I figured, you know, if I'm going to drink, I might as well go where I can do it in style. And I did. I slept in the mission down here, and I slept in a Dempsey dumpster, and I slept in my car, and I would work day labor, and I would sleep in the weeds. And, you know, it just, God, I just, you know, I would wake up some days and wonder, how the hell did I get here from there? How did this happen to me? I finally realized that sitting in the jail in Las Vegas waiting to come back to Utah one more time, that maybe I really ought to go to more meetings and listen to you people. It might keep me out of these places. So I'm sitting in the Davis County Jail fighting not to go back. And in those days, you could have a hearing, a pre-parole revocation hearing, and you could bring all of your witnesses and tell them what a nice guy you are, and you really just took one drink and, you know, maybe if you were given another chance, you wouldn't do those things again. And I was really expecting to be allowed to stay out. I worked at Weber State College, and in my eyes, I'd done pretty well. I had thought that I had met a girl in some bar in Ogden, and she had 5 boys, and I figured I can do something for those kids, so I married her, and I did. They about drove me bananas, and so did she, and I just couldn't be a part of that. So they told me that you will have to go back to the prison. And I was absolutely devastated. I didn't want to go back. I didn't deserve to go back, but I did. And I went in front of the parole board with 11-day growth of beard and a pair of green coveralls on. And George Latimer, who was head of the parole board in those days, said, Jim, what are we going to do with you? He said, if you ever come back in front of this board again, something to the effect, you know, your brain's going to be pickled, and you're going to be here for a long time. And they gave me a 5-month date, and I was released from that system April the 8th, 1975. And it hasn't been necessary for me to go back since. I go back every week, but I'm on my own deal. Another part of that story, I don't like to beat my own drum, but it's kind of nice to get a pat on the back once in a while. And I never realized what had happened in the last few years until this night at the prison. They had an awards banquet for volunteers. And the man who that day had just finished his 10 years being the warden and was now the chairman of the Board of Corrections met me at the door. And I had known him those many years ago when he was the recreation director. And now he was the most powerful man in the prison system in the state of Utah. And he put his arm around me, and he had always called me Jimbo. And he said, do you mind if I talk about you at this awards banquet? And I said, no, I don't. And he talked very briefly about me, about how I had been on what is known as A Block, which is the first place you go after fifth year, and how I had made the complete cycle. I carry a card today that says I'm a non-paid staff member of the Utah State Prison. And that's a hell of a lot of growth for me, to be able to even carry that card, and for me to even be able to want to go out there. But I found that here. There was someone that brought the message to me in that place. And I don't want to forget from whence I came. I don't want to forget the pain that I went through. I don't want to forget the 10 years that I didn't talk to my mother. I couldn't let them know where I was. You know, it's pretty tough to write home and tell them how good you're doing when you got a goddamn number on your chest and you're doing time. It's pretty tough. I didn't want anybody to know. Another one of those personalities that I had. I could be someone else, somewhere else. That's all behind me today, and I don't have any regrets about that part of my life. I understand today a lot better than I ever have that in order for me to be here tonight, I had to do all of those things that were necessary. I understand today a lot better that little card that I carry, why we were chosen. I understand those kinds of things. I was in a marriage in this city with a member of Al-Anon, and after 5 years of that, I got up enough guts, I guess, to go get drunk for 8 months and get the hell out of there. I ended up in a treatment program here in the city, and there are some friends here tonight that I was in there with. It's awful good to see them here. And while you're in the treatment programs in the Haven, there is a little rule that says do not pair off or do not become involved with someone, a patient that is in the program. I didn't. I became involved with the assistant manager. And we were both married at the time and married to other people. And it's highly unlikely that someone with my kind of background would meet someone with Nancy's background except in these rooms. We had dinner tonight with some friends and we were sharing the story with them. And everybody knows it. You know, my life is an open book. We ran away together and we thought we'd take a couple of 3 weeks and just go somewhere and screw each other to death and that would be the end of it. It didn't work that way. Nothing has worked to my plan in my life. There's a little thing there's a line there that somewhere, things happen between lust and love and all of those things. And to me today, love is simply accepting someone just like they are, not wanting to change them. And I, you know, I had to learn that here. I didn't know what love was when I came here. I thought love and sex were the same thing. I thought I had weakness and kindness confused. I thought if you were nice to me, there was some way I could use you. And if you had more money than I did, I wanted to get in your pocket. I like what Bob Earl says, and I try to do it when I meet newcomers. I don't really like to know what they do. Because if I'm working with a newcomer and one guy's a bank president and the other one's a plumber, guess who I'm going to go to dinner with? Plumber's going to have to eat by himself. So I might need that banker. So I don't like to know what people do. And Nancy and I met in the Haven, and we kind of fantasized about each other for a while. And she used to wear silk blouses, and those kind of turned me on. And she had an air about her that I really liked. And I knew if I could get her to Park City on a bearskin rug in front of a fireplace, that we would have a good time. We'd go along about our business. And she walked by me in a hallway one day at the Haven and put out her hand and stuck a key in it and told me to be there. Ironically enough, that place is this hotel. I went. She had all afternoon to get ready. I had it all afternoon to get ready, and it's been beautiful ever since. It hasn't always been easy, but with the things that I've learned in this program and the willingness that I have today to listen and to be a part of your lives, my life is very simple. There are no big deals today. We have a relationship today that was so foreign to me. You know, I had always been put down. I had always been under somebody's thumb. When I was a little kid, my grandmother wouldn't let me ride my bicycle because I would get hurt, or I would hurt the bicycle. And I couldn't go swimming because I might drown, and I can't go skiing because I might break a leg. Jesus Christ, I couldn't do anything. And that's the years that I found quickly that I could go out the windows and I could go do these things. I couldn't play baseball because I might get hit with a ball. And Christ, it's a wonder I didn't turn out to be a fag, you know, with all the... I mean, there's nothing wrong with that if that's your preference, but... I wasn't allowed to do any of those things. Something really unique happened to me. Nancy and I had been together a couple of years, and I like to play cards, as most of you know, and I had been playing poker, and I told her that I would be home about 2, and it's 7:30 in the morning, and I'm coming down Fifth East to go home, and my head is going, coming up with all of these excuses as to why I'm coming in at 7:30 in the morning, and not 2 o'clock like I had promised. And I got to the door, and I was just putting the key in, and the door opened. And, you know, I know what to expect because I had been there for many years. I'm going to catch hell, and I'm going to be in the doghouse, and I'm going to have to eat my dinner out of the garbage can. You know, I'm going to get cold shoulder and hot tongue for a week. And I understand that. The door opens. She said, "Good morning. Did you have fun? Are you hungry? Would you like to take a shower first?" And I said, "What the hell is going on?" Our life together has been like that. You know, we don't, we try not to walk on each other's toes. We allow each other to have their own space. Nothing is a big deal. It is so nice for me today to be able to be laid back and to be able to work with you on a daily basis, to be able to share with you and to be able to talk on the phone. To be able to be sober. I never thought I would get sober. I had a philosophy when I was very young. I wanted to live fast, die young, and leave a lot of memories. And I figured 30 is old enough. Of course, I've done everything and been everywhere, and I'm very grateful today that 30 has passed, and I'm enjoying some good days. I really believe that we all enjoy the fruits of our labor. I believe today that I was a daily drinker most times, and I need to go to a daily meeting. There are days that I seem to be too tired to go, and those are the days that I need to go the worst. I believe today that I will get out of this program exactly what I'm willing to put into it. If I am willing to risk with you and to tell you who I am, I don't have to carry that shit around anymore. My life is an open book. I have told at least one human being everything about my life. Everything. I think I've told more than that, but you know, it's a lot of freedom for me to be able to share with you, and I try not to do it on a bragging basis or any of that stuff. It's just me. This is my life. I am very grateful today to be able to go back to Vermont and share a couple days with my dad, who I didn't know until I was in my early 20s. I had known all of my life who my father was, and I had seen him a few times over the years. And from the time I was about 16, I had spent some time trying to get to know him without him knowing who I was. And when you're the son of a legend in that part of the country, I'm not going to touch that anymore. But he had done and been everything that I wanted to be. I had an opportunity to share a few days with him, and he's a very sick man today. He shared with me that he drank about 25 years too long. He has been sober for a few years now, except for one little slip. He decided to go out and get drunk one day. I don't know if he's an alcoholic, but his simple sharing with me that he had drank 25 years too long, I can understand that. I am very proud to be his son today. I am very proud to be my mother's son today. It wasn't always like that. I always wanted to be somebody else. This program has given me a will to live. I can sleep at night. I don't get angry when the phone rings at 2 o'clock and 4 o'clock with two different 12-step calls in the middle of the night. I don't get angry when I show up at the club at 7 in the morning to meet the guy that I had talked to at 2 o'clock that he promised to be there. I had forgotten until this very second. I said, if you don't drink the rest of the night, I will meet you at the club. He didn't show up. Maybe he drank. I don't know. I know that I don't have the power today to get anybody sober. I also don't have the power to get anybody drunk. I believe that today. I use a lot of people as excuses and reasons and all of those things as to why I drank. Because of me, I drank all I could drink for as long as I could. Because of me today, I don't have to. I'm comfortable. And God, it's nice to be comfortable. I have a daughter in Vermont who will be 21 in December, and she lived with us a couple of different times after I had, I'm getting ahead of my story a little bit, after 13 years of not seeing my ex or my kids, we went back to Vermont, and I had an opportunity to make my amends to those kids and those people, and my daughter came to live with us a couple of times, and she had been smoking those funny cigarettes that don't have labels on them since she was 12 years old. And I mean, a lot of it. And I couldn't put up with that, and I had to ask her to leave, and she went back. And she has graduated from cosmetology school, I enjoyed visiting with her and being with her. She is straight. She is sober. I had nothing to do with it. You know, sometimes I believe that my overbearing will for them to do as I have done is disaster. I know that when I was trying to get sober, people would say some of those nasty things to me, and I just couldn't do that. I could not relate. And as soon as I gave up on Gypsy and just kind of released her with love like the Al-Anons do, I don't know how the hell to release anybody. I know that I can step back out of the way a little bit and let God, as I understand him, kind of run the show. And she's sober and straight today. With any luck at all, maybe my son will get that way. I had a terrible resentment towards a man that is a relative of mine, and he was putting me down for some of the things that I was doing, running around and drinking, and he was doing the same thing. But he had a very responsible job, and he was an upstanding citizen in the community. I had a chance this year to make my amends to him. He too had a chance to make some to me. His wife told me that, you know, we never realized that when you were a kid, maybe all you needed was a friend. I never realized it till that day. I also learned something else about this man. He is not an alcoholic, but he went to meetings for 9 years at a little recovery house in Vermont, which is up in the hills. It's called Maple Leaf Farms. And he went there for 9 years every Saturday night. A friend of his had asked him to help him get sober. And he took him up there, and he got sober. And they went every Saturday for 9 years, and the guy died sober. I'm beginning to learn that I find out a lot about people if I'm willing to give a little bit myself, if I'm willing to risk. And I learned that in these rooms from you people. You gave of your time and your energy to me. And for that, I'm really grateful. I've never seen God, but I know how I feel. It's people like you that make him so real. Thank you very much.
I don't know why. and then you just, I'll look at me and I'll go. anything you can pursue it. So I did it. I was confident I could tell I was seen it. I knew if there had to be an angle and look at it. Yeah, and in the end, there's no business. Stop it. Nah. Stick it in the electric. Oh, she's gonna go with the winner. said, he thought in a minute, he was like, I got here at the summit. He helped us catch Nick on there. The walrus is next to the next thing, yes, so now what the catch was, he helped us all on it. Yeah, so I'm sorry. Wow! keys, but you make history, you can find it out here. That's the nets in there. I can get up with the emotion that you feel off the health system. And I don't know, add that onto India, it hurts the tax on this gun. Oh, you're coming over here, I'll see how this bitter. I'm just going to kill him, cock out, and he's going to run. plastik kapalı bir yer var. Bu güzel olanın etinde yüzü. Ben geçti oyunu. Ne sigara kullanır mı? Oğuz yüzü var. Never get that stuff and all that stuff is good works and you can't even be too good at it. Dang it, oh, I don't know, you should have got it off the other program, but I got other things there, come back to Gush away. And, dang it, oh, I'll just be using the damn costumes while I'm not filming. And then, you're just gonna do your men to do that. Well, what all was it? Sure, what are you doing? I am thinking to do so. Green and blue, so get that heat in the air, but there's no. Sure, I'm going to go up here, may I have a ticket? I didn't wish you see them, but. Sure, sniff, nip, and I'll see if you see it. Sure, the mask all out, nip, son. Father, how you able to do so? All you get for the new building, I'm going to pause, see I'm very his neck, because I'll lose it out. My odd scholar's nation, the other ones, I'll bet you just how you said. Hey, babe, but that's just it. That's he in the back. But just that's the peanut. I hope not. Sail for the roof, you see. No, I know we can get a little massage, there we go, I got an already in early, I said. And then, the old slots over them never come. Yeah, it's going to be beaten out of. Don't get the worst, he's over there. No, I was over them. Damn, damn. See, it's over the bad, young man. But she always did stand it. Because stand is no, so any. I'm going to go to the hospital. I'll be able to get a little bit of a I'm going to get a little bit of a I'm going to get a little bit of 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 a little b necessary for a doctor to hear what they do. So you know, they don't give a lyric to that. I guess they'll go off in New York City, or how could they have? So they'll go out there in the airport. Even the evening. We're building it up. Here's that. The fact that the missing is the seal of the missing is the mystery. Very
Yeah, I'm going to go to the next one.